Well, guys, we have now arrived at the end of the book of 1 Samuel, the last two chapters. And to understand these two chapters, I think we first need to understand that chapters 28 through 31 outline the last 2 days of Saul's life as king and the last 2 days of David's life as fugitive. And therefore, these chapters give you a contrast between two kings in their distress. A contrast between two kings and their distress. These chapters are intertwined together so that we can see how David and Saul respond to very similar problems, which they are going through at the exact same time. And what the author wants to show you is that David is the rightful king to the throne. David is the leader after God's own heart. David is God's chosen man. While Saul is the epitome of failure. He is the epitome of unfaithfulness. And therefore, he will die. And that gives you a theme that I want you to notice throughout our study, and a theme that I think we've seen all throughout our study through this book, and it is this, that God will bless the faithful and punish the unfaithful. God will bless obedience and punish disobedience. God will bless the obedient, and he will cast judgment upon the disobedient. Believers are known for their obedience. Unbelievers are known for their disobedience. We don't try to be obedient because we want to be saved, but we are obedient because we are already saved. And God calls you to live a life of obedience. And if you do, he will bless you. Not by giving you a Mercedes and $1 million, but by giving you joy and strengthening grace and Christ-likeness by walking near to you. And there is no greater thing than that in this world. And so I want you to look at that theme here, and I want you to notice how we see that reality, the reality of this theme culminate in the lives of David and Saul here as we see it nowhere else in this book. That God blesses the obedient and he judges, he curses, he punishes the disobedient. And since this is a contrasting of leaders, I actually found 17 lessons on leadership throughout these two chapters. It's very interesting. The last three sermons I've taught, I've found 15 lessons of something. And so I'm just going on a streak right now. And so we're going to look at 17 lessons on leadership intertwined through these headings that I'm going to give you. And obviously, these lessons are not exhaustive, and these are lessons that certainly apply to Christians in general. But I want to emphasize on leadership today because this is, we're contrasting two kings, two leaders, and also because every one of you has been called to be a leader one day. In fact, you are already a leader in one way or another because leadership is influence, and God has given you a level of influence already. Whether it is with your siblings or with your friends or with whoever it is later on, when you're older, maybe you could have your own small group. You could be a leader there. Maybe you could have your own children with your own family that you could lead. Maybe it could be an organization. Maybe it could be a group of people at work. Maybe it could be a church. Whatever it is, God has given you a level of leadership. And if that is the case, then you need to learn what right leadership looks like and what wrong leadership looks like. And we see that here in David and Samuel. So, 17 lessons on leadership, two kings in their distress, the contrast between God blessing the obedient and judging the disobedient. We're going to learn all those things here. So let's get started with heading number one. And it is this, on the brink of death. On the brink of death. Look at verse 1 with me. It says, then it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day. Now stop there. Stop there. Previously, in 1 Samuel, what we saw is that David was just dismissed. David and his men were dismissed by Achish, the Philistine king, if you remember that, right? Because they were going to go fight Israel, David's people. And David is joining them for some reason, and all the Philistine kings are like, hey, like this is weird. Like, he's going to attack us from behind, which is what I believe he was actually going to do. But anyways, he's dismissed. His people are dismissed. And so most likely, they are leaving. They are being dismissed in a happy manner. Everybody's most likely very happy, okay? The people of David, they're probably thinking, man, we don't have to fight our people. Like, they're probably happy. They get on their horses. They go on this three-day ride back home to their families. And they're just happy. Just think about it. They're ready to be hailed as heroes, ready to be fed by their wives, ready to be welcomed by their children. They're happy until they get close to Ziklag, their city. And they see a large pillar of smoke rising up to heaven. And their hearts begin to sink. Because look at what they find there. Keep reading, verse 1 again. Then it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day that the Amalekites had made a raid on the Negev and on Ziklag and had overthrown Ziklag and burned it with fire. And they took captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great, without killing anyone, and carried them off and went their way. When David and his men came to the city, behold, it was burned with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters had been taken captive. Just imagine the scene. Guys, these are men of war with families and with wives and with children, and they arrive home and all they see is ash and rubble. And I imagine, I mean, they're getting there, and the first thing they do is they get off their horses and they rush to see maybe there's someone still alive under the ash and the rubble. They're thinking maybe someone survived, maybe someone escaped, and they search and they search and they search, and they find nobody. There are no bodies. There's no blood. Everyone has been kidnapped. But by who? By who? Well, they're going to find out who it was that did this in a couple of verses, but the narrator tells us here that it was the Amalekites who did this. Now, who can tell me when was the first time that the Amalekites showed up in the book of 1 Samuel? Alethea?
Chapter 10.
Chapter 10? Is that right? What happened in chapter 10? Remind me.
Saul disobeyed God.
That's chapter 15. Chapter 15. Yeah, so Saul was commanded to obliterate the Amalekites, basically, and he disobeyed, right? He disobeyed. So essentially what you have here, guys, is a repetition of a lesson we've learned all over the place in this book, and it is this, that sin always carries consequences, and that those consequences not only affect you, but they affect everybody else around you, okay, and people that come after you. It's like 40 years have passed since he disobeyed this commandment, Saul. And now David and his people have to basically undo what he did. They basically have to fix what his mess, you could say. And if I were to turn this lesson into some lesson of leadership, it would be this. Leadership lesson number one. Sometimes leadership begins by cleaning up the mess that somebody else left 40 years ago. Yes, because that is exactly what David is about to do here. And I know that as you grow older, you're gonna face this reality, whether it is, you know, in wherever you're hired in any organization, whatever it is, you're looking at the place and you're like, what happened here? And it's like, well, who was leading before? But if there's something that I want you to get from this is that lesson of sin carrying consequences and that affecting not only you, but those who come after you, even 40 years after you. And so the Amalekites kidnap their families, and don't think, guys, that they're kidnapping their families and not killing them because, well, they're nice people and they don't want to kill people. But no. They kidnap them, and they're keeping them alive because they want to sell them as slaves, most likely, to slave traders. And now let's see how David and his men responded to this. Look at verse 4. Read it with me. It says, then David and the people who were with him lifted their voices and wept until there was no strength in them to weep. And I'd add to that, no strength even to stand up, most likely. These are the strongest warriors weeping their hearts out in a burned city. Just imagine that. They're broken, lying on the dirt with no strength but to stay there and die because their families, they think they lost their families. Now, verse 5. This verse zeroes in on David and his distress. Verse 5, it says, now, David's two wives had been taken captive Ahinoam and the Jezreelites and Abigail. I'm pronouncing all these words wrong. The Jezreelites. Forget about it. You know what I'm saying. And Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite. Moreover, David was greatly distressed because the people, notice this, the people spoke of stoning him. For all the people were embittered, each one because of his sons and his daughters. So David is faced with two problems. An internal problem. He's broken because his wives have been taken away. And that's messed up, by the way, of course, these two wives. But that's an internal problem. And then an external problem. His own loyal men have turned on him. And they want to stone him and kill him. And that gives us a second lesson on leadership. Some of these lessons are going to be pretty long, so you can write them in your own words. But this is it. In any group or organization, the person who ultimately carries the blame and weight of problems is the leader. The leader. Listen, guys, part of being a leader is having to face the consequences and the blame of failure. And these men would have been thinking, well, David is our leader. David should have thought about this. David should have thought about protecting our families. It's his fault. And certainly there's a sense in here in which they're not thinking straight because they're consumed with emotion. But at the same time, you need to see here, though, the weightiness of leadership. Because in a sense, it was David's fault. He should have thought of this. Now, before we get to our next verse, I want you to see something in verse 6. Go back there real quick. It says, moreover, David was greatly distressed. These words, greatly distressed, have already been used recently to describe someone else in chapter 28, and that is Saul. In chapter 28, when Saul goes to the witch of Endor, do y'all remember that? Yes, so he goes to the witch of Endor, to the medium, and Saul comes. Samuel comes out, and he's like, hey, why are you waking me up? And Saul tells him, he tells him this, just listen. I am greatly distressed, verse 15 says, for the Philistines are waging war against me, and God has departed from me and no longer answers me. And so I want you to consider this. Chapter 28 is happening at exactly the same time as this chapter. So at the same time, while David is saying that he's greatly distressed, Saul is telling Samuel that he's greatly distressed. This is the same night. Remember what I told you at the beginning. This is the contrasting between two kings in their distress. And so at the same time, both of them are being pressed in troubles that are so heavy, they're on the brink of death, you could say. But in contrast to Saul, who never ran to God, we read at the end of verse 6 that, look back again at the end of verse 6, David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. So Saul, in his distress, runs to a medium and finds no strength. David, in his distress, runs to God and finds all the strength he needs. And by the way, the next verses are going to tell us that God is going to promise David that basically he's basically going to be able to rescue everybody that was kidnapped. But what you need to understand is that in this moment, David is finding strength in God before he gets any assurance of that. Which tells you that it wasn't the assurance of God that things would turn out well, which strengthened him, but simply the fact that he understands that God is God and that he is in God's hands and that in the end God will be glorified. This is a man saying, he might just die that on that day. He's thinking maybe that's going to happen, but he's saying, God, you're my joy, you're my peace, you're my all. And in the end, let your will be done. Let your kingdom come. Let your will be done on earth, in my life, right now as it is in heaven. That alone can give a man peace when he's in this situation. The understanding and the ultimate desire for God to be glorified, even if his men stone him that night. For God to be glorified. And so that gives us our third lesson. Godly leader finds strength in God. He, she desires the glory of God above all things. And then I added this. He holds success and reputation with an open hand. An open hand. I mean, he's saying, if you want to take my success away, if you want to take my men away, if you want to take my life away, if you want to take my family away, let your will be done. Be glorified. I don't think anybody could be in this situation and have any other thing in life give him or her peace than this? It's like he just lost everything. He's holding everything with an open hand. And how is he able to find strength in God? Only in that, Lord, you are in control. Be glorified. That's it. Now let's see what else David does in verse 7. It says, then David said to Abiathar, the priest, the son of Ahimelech. Now stop there. David's about to tell this priest to get guidance from God for him. But before we look at that, you need to notice who the priest was. It says that he was Abiathar, the priest, the son of Ahimelech. We've already read about this guy before, right? Who was this guy?
So David asked him for food and lied to him and told him that Saul sent him, and it ended up getting him killed.
That's exactly right. That's chapter 22. So Ahimelech was the guy, was the priest, the chief priest, whom Saul killed with all the towns of the town of priests, right? And there was one guy that escaped, Abiathar. He went to find help and rescue and protection from David, right? And so this is you could say the last priest standing, in a sense. And Saul is somewhere in the distance running to a medium trying to get divine guidance in his distress while David has a priest. Why can't the king of Israel just summon a priest and ask him for help? Why?
He killed them all.
Which reminds you guys that sin makes you stupid. And sin makes you do things that you will regret for the rest of your life. It's like, don't you think Saul is probably thinking, man, if I only had a priest with me, you know? Anyways. Look at verse 7 again. It says, so then David said to Abiathar, the priest, the son of Ahimelech, please bring me the ephod. So Abiathar brought the ephod to David. David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I pursue this man? Shall I overtake them? And he, that is God, said to him, pursue, for you will surely overtake them, and you will surely rescue all. Leadership lesson number 4. Godly leader relies on the word of God for guidance. Some of these lessons, they apply to everybody, not a leader. Of course, I want to put the emphasis of leadership, but a godly leader or a godly Christian, every godly Christian will rely on the word of God for guidance. And that's exactly what David does. And God tells him to pursue the people who kidnapped their families and basically tells him, you're going to rescue everybody. So good news. Now, contrast that with the response Saul is getting from Samuel at this exact moment. Chapter 28, verses 17 through 19, just listen. Samuel is saying to Saul, right now, at this exact moment, God has torn the kingdom from you because you've been disobedient. God will make sure the Philistines defeat you in battle in the morning. Oh, and by the way, God will make sure that the Philistines kill you and your sons. That's what Saul is being told. So the contrast of two kings in their distress, David gets a promise of deliverance in life. Saul gets a promise of defeat and death. And now what we see in the remainder of this chapter is how God's promise of life to David is fulfilled, how it unfolds. And then in chapter 31, how God's promise of death to Saul unfolds. So let's begin with how God's promise to David unfolds. Remember, David had just got the promise that he'd rescue everybody. So let's look at how he responds to this. Look at verse 9. It says, so David went, he and the 600 men who were with him, and came to the brook Besor, where those left behind remained. But David pursued, he and 400 men, for 200 who were too exhausted to cross the brook Besor remained behind. So 200 soldiers are too tired, too exhausted. I mean, they've traveled for a while, so they're like, hey, we're staying behind. And so David is left with 400 guys, and they're on a rescue mission. And they're going fast in the middle of the night. And it seems that they begin catching up because look at what happens in verse 11. It says, now they found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David and gave him bread and he ate. And they provided him with water to drink. They gave him a piece of fig cake and 2 clusters of raisins and he ate. Then his spirit revived, for he had not eaten bread or drunk water for 3 days and 3 nights. So lying on the ground, they find this half-dead Egyptian, and they see him, and they're really nice to him. And they feed him. And certainly they're doing this because, I mean, they're wanting to get clues on where the Amalekites are, or their enemies are. But I want you to notice what they feed him. It says bread, fig cake, in clusters of raisins. The point is, they're being really nice to this guy. And that gives us, I think, a fifth lesson on leadership. A godly leader, or again, a godly Christian, does not allow his problems to impede him from showing kindness. Listen, there are times when you will go through very difficult circumstances. And people who do this, people who go through very difficult circumstances, they can purposely begin to think that they can use their problems as an excuse to not show kindness. That's not the case for a godly leader or a godly Christian. You, when you go through trouble, when you are suffering, don't ever think that you can take a vacation off from living for people. You love God by loving his people. You serve always. And it may also be that David's doing this out of obedience to God. Multiple times in the Torah, God commands the Israelites to love aliens, and not like space people from space green people, but like people from other nations. Love them. In fact, in Leviticus 19, it says he commands them to love them as you love yourselves. And so it seems that David is sees a stranger, and that's exactly what he does. He simply seems to obey, which gives us a sixth lesson. A godly leader does not use his problems as an excuse to disobey God. David clearly does not do that here. Now let's keep going. David and his men feed this Egyptian, and then look at verse 13. Now I want you to read it with me, guys. David said to him, "To whom do you belong, and where are you from?" And he said, "I am a young man of Egypt, a servant of an Amalekite, and my master left me behind when I fell sick 3 days ago." And then he spills the beans. "We made a raid on the Negev of the Cherethites, and on that which belongs to Judah, and on the Negev of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire." That's David's town. Verse 15, "Then David said to him, 'Will you bring me down to this band?'" And notice David's wisdom right there. He doesn't reveal anything to him. This guy doesn't know who David is. But David just asks for a favor, it seems. Keep reading verse 15. "And he," the Egyptian, "said, 'Swear to me by God that you will not kill me or deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will bring you down to this band.'" Wow. And in the end, it seems that David does swear, because immediately verse 16 jumps us to when they arrive with the Amalekites. Read 16 with me. When he had brought him down, so when the Egyptian had brought David down to the Amalekites, behold, they were spread over all the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil that they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. Imagine the scene. It says they went down to them. So what you have here is basically David and his men basically looking down from a hill, most likely, to this encampment of what could have been perhaps thousands of Amalekites. And it says they're just having a 3 a.m. party. They're dancing and singing and rejoicing, and they're just boasting and rejoicing and dancing and partying because of their success. And they're probably thinking, man, all the money we're going to make with all these people we just kidnapped. And David had 600 men. All their families were kidnapped. That means that most likely there's about 2,000 people perhaps there chained on the ground, and everybody else is dancing around them. And what they don't know is that David and his men are watching at a distance. And amazingly, the text doesn't give any hints on what exactly the plan was or how they went about it, but read verse 17. It says, "David slaughtered them from the twilight until the evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled." And again, we get a contrast between David and Saul. Remember, at the exact same time, Saul is fighting a war with the Philistines. At the exact same time, Saul is being killed on another battlefield while David is basically killing everybody. Saul is losing the war, his war, while David is winning his. Verse 18. "So David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken and rescued his two wives. But nothing of theirs was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything that they had taken for themselves. David brought it all back." So they got everything. And not only everything, they got all of the spoil that the Amalekites had gotten from the other towns that they raided. So they're basically rich now. They're super rich. And look at what all the men who previously wanted to stone David are saying now. Verse 20. So David had captured all the sheep and the cattle, which the people drove ahead of the other livestock. And they said, "This is David's spoil." They're basically saying, take the best spoil. Take the sheep. Take the livestock. Give it to our captain, our hero. It's like, it's completely the opposite of where we started. And look at verse 21. When David came to the 200 men who were too exhausted to follow David, who had also been left at the brook Besor, and they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him, then David approached the people and greeted them. Now, remember who these people are, who these men are. These were the men who were too exhausted to keep going, right? And so they stayed behind, 200 men. And I mean, think about it. How would people respond to that? It's like, we just rescued all your family and you stayed back to sleep. Some people would have been mad. But instead of that, it says that David approached the people and greeted them. And greeted them, that phrase literally means to ask them for peace, to ask them for peace. And this honestly reminds me of Jesus when he goes to the disciples in the room after he has risen again and after the disciples have abandoned him and it's like they just abandoned him, and he shows up and he says, peace be upon you, peace be upon you. It's like, it's amazing. David is acting again with kindness, with patience. There's no sense of bitterness in him, but that's not the case for everybody in the group, because look at what happens in verse 22. Then all the wicked and the worthless men among those who went with David said, because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except to every man his wife and his children, that they may lead them away and depart. So they're basically saying, ha, you cowards. It's like we go out there and risk our lives and you stay here in bed all comfy and safe. You know what? You don't deserve this spoil. Just take your family and leave. Get out of here. You're not one of us anymore. And you have these worthless men, it says, saying these things. And then David arrives, and look at how he handles the situation. Verse 23. Then David said, you must not do so, my brothers. Now, stop there. He calls these people brothers. He's the king. And they just went against his pronouncement of peace. And he calls them brothers. In contrast to all the insults that Saul gave his men when he thought they were going against him. Which gives you another lesson on leadership, by the way. That a godly leader is a peacemaker. A godly leader is a peacemaker. David was a peacemaker. He didn't look for fights, but sought to unite and to reconcile his people. After all, don't you think that if there was someone who was going to have any bitter thoughts against him, it would have been David? I mean, they literally just wanted to kill him a couple of hours ago, but he doesn't even mention it. And I think that gives us another lesson on leadership, and it is this. A godly leader is humble. He does not exalt himself above his people. So in calling them brothers, David is essentially positioning himself as one of them. He is a king, but he's not a king like Pharaoh, who exalted himself above his subjects because he is apparently divine. David doesn't do that. David is, as it were, grabbing them by the shoulder and saying, my brothers, you must not do this. Let's rejoice instead. It reminds me of someone else, by the way, of another king who would later come and stoop so low as to becoming one of us, and of whom Hebrews 2:11 says that he, Jesus, is not ashamed to call us brothers. Now read verse 23 with me again. It says, then David said, you must not do so, my brothers. With what the Lord has given us, who has kept us and delivered into our hand the band that came against us. Ninth lesson on leadership. A godly leader gives the credit to God. And that's exactly what David does here. And not only that, but he's helping the people that were not giving the credit to God to start giving the credit to God. Now, when Saul, if you remember chapter 15, when Saul killed some of the Amalekites, did he give the credit to God? What did he do after that? Do y'all remember that? What did he do? Samuel?
I am so amazing.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, he said, I'm so amazing. And he said that to the degree that he made a statue of himself. You remember that? Chapter 15. He literally did that. It's crazy. But instead of that, David tells everyone, listen, I did nothing, you did nothing, God gave us the victory. So stop complaining. Then he continues talking to these guys in verse 24. Look at it with me. It says, and who will listen to you in this matter? For as his share is who goes down to the battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage. They shall share alike. So it has been from that day forward that he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day. So essentially, David is establishing this ordinance where it's saying, whether you go or you stay, you're getting the same spoil. And because again, the Lord is the one who brings victory. And I think there's an aspect of the shepherding care of David in saying that. The shepherding care, the compassion that he has towards the weak men that were with him, which gives us, I think, another lesson on leadership, a tenth lesson. A godly leader shows compassion to the weak. I have heard of pastors, guys, who as soon as they meet troublesome people, as soon as they meet people that bring trouble to the church, they try to find any way to just kick them out. It's like, I'm not dealing with you. If David had that mentality, he would have just said, you know what, you troublemakers, you weak people, just get out. I'm not having any drama in my kingdom. But that's not what he does. That's not what a godly leader does. Instead, he shepherds them and unites them both. He cares for his sheep. Now, there's another leadership lesson found in these verses. David is essentially correcting his men in their sin. And he's calling out sin, and he's pushing his sheep back in line. And so here's the 11th lesson. A godly leader will call out, correct, and instruct against sin and towards righteousness. Back in chapter 15, when Samuel came and called out Saul for his sin in sparing the Amalekites, what is the excuse that Saul gave? You remember that?
The people.
It was the people, Samuel. They wanted to keep them alive. I know how God told me to do this, but the people, man. It's their fault, not me. Which shows you what? That he didn't instruct his people. He listened to the people in their sin rather than teaching them and correcting them. Instead of that, David he's correcting it immediately. He's shepherding his people. That's not what Saul did. Now, look at what else David does once this is settled. Verse 26. Now, when David came to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah, to his friends, saying, behold, a gift for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord. 27. To those who were in Bethel, and to those who were in Ramoth of the Negev, and to those who were in Jadur, and to those who were in Aror, and to those who were in Sifmoth, and to those who were in Eshtemoah, and to those who were in Rechol. I'm actually doing pretty good here. And to those who were in the cities of the Jeramelites, and to those who were in the cities of the Canaanites, and to those who were in Hormah, and to those who were in Borashan, and to those who were in Atach, and to those who were in Hebron, and to all the places where David himself and his men were accustomed to go. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, so essentially, David takes from all the spoil that he got from the enemies of the Lord, and he just gives it out to his men, and not only to his men, but to all his friends across the land. And the message he sent to them, just look at it again. Verse 26, he says, behold, a gift for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord. And again, that shows you that he's giving all the credit to God. And the word for gift here refers to a blessing, meaning that David is not afraid to call it what it is. He's not afraid or ashamed or embarrassed to use theological language. He wants them to know, this is from the hand of God. God punished his enemies. Here it is. I like that. And which gives us, I think, another lesson. A godly leader is unashamedly bold when it comes to the truth and the honor of God. And we see that here. And there's something else that I want you to see about David here. If you remember in chapter 8, when Saul was described, he was described as someone who would take everything away from the people. Saul was described as a tyrant, right? But in contrast to that, we see David here being recognized as the giving king, who gives to everyone according to his abundant supply. And that reminds me of John 17, which we studied a while ago. You sixth graders were not here, but we studied John 17 here. And I remember telling you that I counted how many times the verb to give is repeated in that chapter, and I counted 17 times, which taught us that God is a giving God. And isn't it interesting that now the man after God's own heart is recognized as the giving king? So the giving God gives his people, the giving king who gives to all out of his abundant supply. I love that. I love that. Which gives us a 13th lesson, and it is this. A godly leader is a giver, like David, not a taker, like Saul. And there's another very important lesson to learn here. Just give it to you right now. A godly leader is wise as serpents and innocent as doves. In giving out all these gifts, David was not just being kind, he was also being very wise. He was being innocent and yet cunning at the same time. Multiple times I think that he does this throughout the chapter. He's meek and innocent. He's almost childlike. He has an aura of innocence, and yet at the same time, there's a strategic plan he's mustering up behind the scenes. And like, for example, the Egyptian guy he helped is like, yes, he's being very kind, but obviously he's being wise because he knows he's going to help him. Or like, for example, Achish in the last chapter, his BFF, you know? It's like, obviously, he's the enemy of God. Why is David being so kind to him? Why is he doing the things he's doing? Because I think he was going to attack him. Or in this case, he's being very cunning and strategic in that David is giving all this spoil that he has to potential political friends. He's following the idea that is found in Proverbs 19:6, which says that every man is a friend to him who gives gifts. So he's making a political move, and he wants to be in good terms with neighboring nations, and he's also sending two messages, if you think about it, in doing this. He's saying, here you go, these gifts from the enemies of God, the spoil from the enemies of God, and he's basically saying, God did this, don't mess with us. Don't mess with me, because I'm on God's side. Not only that, he's saying, not only don't mess with me, but hey, let's be friends. In fact, here's a gift. That's what he's doing. He's being very, very wise about it. And by the way, all of these places seem to be intentionally picked as places of influence that would help him become king in the end, to the point that the last place described here is Hebron. In 2 Samuel, it says that he was crowned king in Hebron. He's being very intentional in all of this. And of course, that does not mean that this is endorsing, or I'm endorsing, having double motives, but I think it backs up Jesus' words in Matthew 10:16, that believers must be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. Always kind, always innocent, always having this aura of childlikeness, as I said, and yet always being wise and never letting our guard down and never being naive and never being lost in the place. Like, you know what's going on around you. Even though you're very kind and you're very innocent and you believe the best, you're being very wise of what's going on. And I think David shows that as a leader here in a great way. And also, guys, it's really interesting. If you look at the end of verse 31, it says that he sent gifts to all the places where David himself and his men were accustomed to go. And then verse 26 says that he sent gifts to all his friends. And yet, isn't it interesting that he did not send gifts to the only place where he lived for the past year and a half? Isn't it interesting that he did not send gifts to Achish, his BFF? Why? Well, I think it is because he was, in fact, trying to attack them. Again, showing his wisdom and cunningness, in a sense. And so, you could say everything is providentially falling into place. Here's a man after God's own heart. He's an awesome king. He's going to be a wise and kind and patient and loving leader. But one thing is left to happen if he's going to be made king. What is that? Saul's got to die. That's exactly right. And so we just saw God's promise of life to David unfold. Let's now look at how God's promise to Saul unfolds. Look at chapter 31. We'll go through it fast. And just remember, guys, also chronologically, everything that's happening here is happening at the same time as David was fighting the Amalekites. And everything here is a fulfillment of the word from God through Samuel that he got in chapter 28. So let's study it. Verse 1. Now the Philistines were fighting against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines killed Jonathan and Abinadab in Mount Sheshua, the sons of Saul. So Saul's sons, including Jonathan, are dead. Just like Samuel said would happen. Again, reminding you that your sin affects those around you too. Anyway, so they die, and the rest of the armies of Israel die or flee, and amidst the bloody battlefield, the narrator now zeroes in to one last lonely figure, and that is Saul. Look at verse 3. The battle went heavily against Saul, it says, and the archers hit him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. Remember, God prophesied that he would die on this day, and it's interesting that he's still alive. It's like, why is he still alive? It's almost as if God wants to show us a little more of the colors of Saul. What is he going to do? He's half dead. What are his last words? How is he going to respond to everything that's going on around him? Verse 4. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and pierce me through with it. Otherwise these uncircumcised will come and pierce me through and make sport of me." These are the words of defeat. He knows he's lost the battle. Not against the Philistines, but against God. His entire life has been fighting God. And wouldn't you think that in the last moments of his life, he would beg God for mercy? Wouldn't you think that he would call out to him? It's like he's about to die. And what does he do? He's still only concerned about his preservation and comfort. So that he's afraid to be in the hands of the Philistines. It's like you're about to be in the hands of an angry God. He's going to pour his wrath on you. And you're thinking about the Philistines. What's wrong with you? Now, keep reading. Halfway through verse 4, it says, "But his armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. So Saul took his sword and fell on it. When his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. And so like Judas, like Hitler, like other evil leaders throughout history, at the sight of utter failure, Saul just killed himself. And some time ago, I told you guys about that demotivational quote of the half-sunken ship that said, maybe the purpose of your life is to work as a warning for others, right? There's nobody in this planet that works more to represent that than Saul. He's an utter failure. He had it all, and yet he lost it all, and he killed everyone through the process. And there's a question I want to ask you in light of that tragedy that Saul is, and it is this. You can write this question down. What kind of legacy do you want to leave after you die? What kind of legacy do you want to leave after you die? Because here's the 15th lesson of leadership you need to understand. Every leader will leave a legacy. Every leader will leave a legacy, whether it is of death and failure or of life and victory and obedience, you will leave a legacy. I started this series by telling you that a people will not rise above their leaders, but rather that a people will turn out to be like their leaders. And so Saul kills himself, and what does his last companion do? Kills himself also. Like leader, like follower. Like leader, like people. We see that again. And mixed with this 15th lesson on leadership is a 16th lesson that I think is implied and which you have to learn, and it is this. Godly leaders bring the best out of their people, while bad leaders bring the worst out of them. So David brings the best out of his people. He brings unity. He brings peace. He brings trust in them in battle for in God, right? He shows them what a godly leader is like, and he's leading them as a shepherd. But in contrast to that, Saul causes his last companion to lose all hope that he kills himself. Brings the worst out of him. Verse 6. It says, "Thus Saul died with his three sons, his armor bearer, and all his men on that day together." So what is the legacy of Saul? Death. Everyone dead because of him. Verse 7. When the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley with those who were beyond the Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned the cities and fled. And the Philistines came and lift them. So those are the people still alive, are left helpless, leaderless, cityless, and the Philistines have control over the entire land. And is it not interesting that that's exactly where they were when we started this book? That's exactly where they were 40 years ago, or 40 years prior, before Saul came in. It's like he's done nothing to solve the problem. Verse 8, "It came about on the next day when the Philistines came to strip the slain, that they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. They cut off his head and stripped off his weapons and sent them throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to the people. They put his weapons in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan." What a tragic and humiliating ending. Verse 11. "Now when the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men rose and walked all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Beth-shan. And they came to Jabesh and burned them there. They took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days." It's interesting. Notice where these people who came and took the bodies down, where they're from. Jabesh Gilead, it says. So if you remember, this is the city where the Spirit of God came upon Saul, and it is the only time when Saul actually showed any faithfulness. So it seems that the only people who ever saw something noble in Saul, they're the only ones who are showing honor to Saul. Most likely because they most likely didn't get to see the darker side of Saul, that who Saul really was. But this is also a tragedy in that Saul's followers, who still seem to show some allegiance to him in the end, you read this, and there's a clear ignorance and paganism in them, because cremation was not a Jewish thing. The Jews didn't do that. They believed in the resurrection. They buried their dead. And so what you have here is very well-intentioned people, but they're ignorant and so entangled in paganism that they don't even know that. They do that to Saul. And so this is very ironic. Again, they're well-intentioned, but they're ignorant of the truth. And the lesson here is that these men are a picture of the best that an incompetent leader can create. Well-intentioned, yet ignorant and pagan as they could be. That's what Saul created. And so, guys, we come to the end of the book. And if there is a final lesson that I would want to give you, wait, don't pack up. Don't back up. I still got one last. I have 17 lessons, guys. If there's one final lesson I want to give you on leadership from this chapter, and I would even say from the entire book, it is this. Now, this lesson is going to be long, but it's long because this is the final lesson of the book, so bear with me. There you go. It's I know. Sorry. Hey, I'm almost done, okay? All right, 17. God is sovereign. You don't have to write it down. Just listen, and then you can write it down in your own words. God is sovereign over every ruler in this world. He can exalt the nobodies and shatter the monarchs. He will bring judgment upon wicked leaders and blessing upon righteous ones. And just like he sent David to rule over Israel, he will soon send his son to rule over the world. That's it. And so, in a sense, the questions we began with are answered. The theme that I presented to you from the very start is... You're all trying to write it down. All right, I'll keep talking. The theme was the utter need of a righteous king, right? And the questions were, will this king come? Who will this king be? Well, now we know it's going to be David, momentarily speaking. And will he solve the problem of Israel? Saul didn't solve the problem of Israel, but David is a righteous king. We just saw it. He will do it. And then Christ will come and solve the problem of the world. David is here. He can rule. Saul is dead. The door is wide open. But what is missing? What is missing? The Messiah. Okay. Well, so talking about this situation right here, contextually, the door is wide open for him to reign. He's not, well, what is missing right here? Anybody? Barbara? What is it? Sin? Okay, let me be more clear. All right, so the evil king is dead. The people need a ruler. David is, he's there. He's been provided. What is missing? Yeah, well, he hasn't become king yet, right? He hasn't been crowned official king yet, right? And so in a sense, this is just the beginning, or the end of the beginning of David's reign, which means that we have no other option but to start studying 2 Samuel next week. Yeah. I'm excited. I hope y'all are excited. All right, let's do that. Let's pray, and we'll be done. Thank you, Father, for this book once again. Thank you for the lessons that you've taught us through it. We ask you, oh Lord, help us. Help us to embody these lessons, to act upon them, to be the kind of leader that honors you, and to be a light in the world, and to be faithful to you, and to look to our King, and to trust you as David trusted you here. Thank you that you are sovereign and good. Thank you once again for this blessing that you've given us to study this. In Jesus' name, amen.